Hey guys, Ron Placone here. You're listening to the Indie Bohemians. We got a big episode today. It's a long one. My guest is Dave Landau. He's a comedian. He was on Last Comic Standing. He's been on Comedy Central. He's also made a movie called The King. And he's had a very complicated life, wrought with depression, suicide, alcoholism, addiction, police brutality, Agent Orange, the health insurance industry scandals. It's all in here. It's a packed episode today, and I'm real excited to bring it to you. A little bit of housekeeping, if I would please. Next week, February 12th and 13th, that's not this weekend coming up, but the following weekend, I will be at the Mason City Limits Comedy Club along with Carmen Morales. That's part of our Well, Here It Goes comedy tour. That's the caravan of comedy that we're on heading out to Los Angeles. We get to Los Angeles in April, as many of you already know. Some of our stops along the way are together. Some of them are separate, but in a similar region. And this whole tour, we're calling it the Well, Here It Goes comedy tour. Hashtag WHIG, all capital, comedy tour. So I'll be updating you more on that. But without further ado, I want to get straight along with the episode. Without further ado, did you hear that? That was, wow. This is what happens when I'm in a hurry. Anyway, indiebohemians@gmail.com. Not going to say any more. Stoked for today's episode. I'm Ron Placone. You're listening to the Indie Bohemians.
It's time for the Monkey Minute. I'm Angie Doran for the Indie Bohemians. An Australian man, age 27, has been diagnosed with Zika virus after being bitten by a monkey and mosquitoes in Bali. Sure, blame the monkey right away, eh? 2016's El Nino could cause the Zika virus to spread even further. The Americas are expected to see 4 million cases of the disease this year, and fears are growing for the Rio Olympics. Athletes are considering not competing. The virus, which has spread now to 23 countries, causes brain defects in babies. That's the Monkey Minute. I'm Angie Doran for the Indie Bohemians.
Hey guys, Ron Placone here. Donald Trump may not have won in Iowa, but he has a new supporter, Kid Rock. Only God knows why. Kid Rock said, quote, "Let the expletive businessman run the country like an expletive business." Run the country like a business. Apparently, Kid Rock feels the same way about politics as he does about songwriting. But why not run it like a business? As Kid Rock points out yet again, what business is gonna survive when it's broke? I don't know, Kid. Maybe a business that gets bailout money from daddy. Now, when it comes to political views, Kid Rock says he doesn't like, quote, hardcore views on either side. And if his music is any indication, Kid Rock probably doesn't like hardcore anything, except for maybe porn. Now, if this ends up being Trump versus Bernie, not only will these be two completely different candidates representing completely different ends of the spectrum, but they'll also be that different even when it comes to music. Bernie Sanders was really interested in the punk rock movement in the 70s and 80s. At one point in Vermont, he helped fund an all-ages venue in the town because he wanted those bands to be able to play there. So Bernie Sanders indirectly helped the punk rock movement in America. Donald Trump ran a bunch of casinos into the ground, so he's partially responsible for all the worst cover bands you can ever imagine. Much like Sarah Palin, another useless endorsement for Donald Trump, the only group that's happy about this is the Campaign Planning Committee, who realizes that if by chance Trump wins this thing, at least they won't have to get three doors down to play. This is Ron Placone, signing out.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Forkful of Noodles. I am Krish Mohan. The Mall. The essence of consumerism in America. For ages, these monoliths have given teenagers a place to gather, loiter, and have awkward conversations.
Hey, Becky.
What's up?
Oh, nothing. Just chillin'.
Cool.
Cool.
Yeah, real cool.
Malls have been a representation of the fact that we are ruled by material possessions and our need for meaningless, vapid conversation. Just ask her out, Brandon. Stop pretending like you're too cool for school. Your mom picked out your outfit. You're not that cool. But now malls have become something different. In Providence, Rhode Island, the oldest mall in the world has become affordable micro-apartments. From the corpse of the advertising and consumer machine comes a great way to provide housing for a whole new group of people. This is the start of something huge. Turning dead malls into housing is the start of us realizing that we've wasted space for far too long, and we can start using this developed space for useful things. Imagine a world where kids actually play outside and do activities and learn life and conversation skills. And in that same world, the homeless have a place to live. The low-income mall employee can get a better job and then live in the space that the American Eagle he used to work at used to be. We can live in a world where we focus our attention on educating ourselves rather than giving tribute to only having stuff. We can stop deforestation and destroying what's left of Mother Earth and start taking care of this place. Perhaps this will be the beginning of a shift in a positive direction for climate change and letting the planet repair itself. And maybe, just maybe, Brandon and Becky will get over how cool they are and just move in with each other already in a brand new micro apartment in the former mall where they first met. That's been your Forkful of Noodles for this week. Thank you for tuning in, and we will see you next week.
Hey guys, Ron Placone here. You're listening to the Indie Bohemians. My guest today is Dave Landau, a comic out of Detroit who has made a movie.
That's right.
And has done a lot of cool stuff, has an awesome upbringing. We're going to dive into it, man.
Thanks for taking
the time to do this.
Thank you for having me, man. I appreciate it.
We're in a hotel lobby. We're on the road together in Decatur, Illinois.
It's a Hawthorne Inn. It's pretty... pretty nice, actually.
It's very nice. Yeah. Unfortunately, the acoustics in my room were awful. That street is so loud.
It really is.
It's so loud. And I was listening, and the more I was just there, the more I noticed that, oh, this is terrible. Like the acoustics are awful. There's some weird buzzing in my room. I think it's just the fridge, which I'm thankful. I'm glad I have a fridge because I need one.
Right.
But it's so, I was like, we can't record
it. It's horrible for recording. Well, I grew up like a block from a freeway. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think I sleep well because of it.
Really?
Just it's the like sound of traffic. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's kind of nice for me, but it is not good for audio.
Oh, yeah, totally. Right. So we're in the breakfast room, so if the phone rings at the hotel or people are checking in, it's just going to be part of the ambiance.
Exactly, when they look over at us doing this.
Right, yeah. It's just going to be part of it all. But that's what we do here. We're very much a grassroots traveling operation, especially these days. So, dude, you grew up in Detroit.
I grew up in, Detroit, Michigan. I grew up in Grosse Pointe Woods, which is this, like, enclave of Detroit where it's sort of middle to upper class. And I grew up, like, right on the border of the two cities, basically.
Now, I did not get to watch the movie yet.
Yes.
But let's dive into that, then, and how that connected to your upbringing, how that connected to your childhood.
Well, the movie's about a kid who gets his first car in the 90s, goes into the ghetto of Detroit to buy beer, and all hell breaks loose is basically the plot. And I used to go into the... I lived right off 8 Mile, and I would go into the city, which would take 30 seconds, and go to this place called Piccadilly and get a homeless person to buy beer, until I had a fake ID. It was very easily accessible. If you needed drugs or alcohol, you just kind of went left instead of right out of my house. But basically, it's just like a story from one of those nights amped up. You know, it's like taking kids and characters that I knew. One of the characters in the movie is a drug dealer named Claw. He's based on a couple of my friends. The girl in the movie that I wrote is based on a couple girls I dated. Basically, everything that happens in the movie is something that's based on my life. And when I was a kid, I was just a drugged out, heavy drinking mess. So it's sort of based on those days. Even though that doesn't necessarily come across in the movie, it is just about a 90s party kid and a night that goes completely awry.
So you wrote the movie.
Yes.
And then you did pitch it around.
I pitched it around. I actually had an offer from a studio, but the offer I did not like at all, and this was actually when I was living in LA, and I decided to go back to Detroit and film it. So what I did was I just took 14 days and $7,000 that I raised and made the movie.
Are you glad you went that route?
I am. Yeah. I'm really happy with the product. I mean, it's not perfect. I made it for $7,000 in 2 weeks, and I did a lot of guerrilla filming, so it was just no
permits. What do you mean by that?
No permits. Just okay. Filmed wherever I wanted. Just did it. And I mean, I was in Detroit. Half the scenes took place in some pretty rough areas, so we just filmed in those areas. I mean, there aren't cops there anyway to stop us. So instead of going the normal way that you would make a movie, we just kind of said, you know, heck with it and just did it.
Yeah. Were there any notable interruptions?
Like this? There was one where we were on this one street and we had a cop car.
Okay.
And it was two guys dressed as cops. We realized if the cops showed up, it probably wasn't good to have police officers that were armed on the set with no permits at all.
Oh, wow.
You know, because it was just two comedians in all cop attire. And also there was a drug deal going on right there at the time, so they were really skeptical of us. So they kept holding it off because they thought we were filming something with actual police. So that was weird. So basically we're hoping that the people in the neighborhood didn't realize we weren't cops, but we were hoping that, you know, real cops didn't show up either.
So how do you feel about Detroit, like, now? Because, I mean, I love that city. I celebrate that city a lot.
Thank you.
We have an affiliate in Flint that I like a bunch.
Yeah.
FYI Nation, to give them a shout-out. And but so where do you – because, I mean, I have nothing but love for that city, and I defend it to a lot of people that talk down on it.
Thank you.
You know, so like, where are you at with it now as someone who has returned –
I love my city, and that's a large reason why I went home. I went home to make the movie, and then my wife got pregnant, and we decided to kind of stay there to be with friends and family and that kind of thing. But my wife works for a company that's huge in Detroit right now, and that's a huge thing for us. She gets good health benefits and that. But, I mean, that's not the question. I love my city. I think it produces amazing music, amazing film, amazing talent. Even people that are coming out right now, like Keegan-Michael Key from Key & Peele, that's a Detroit guy. The show Detroiters that's going to be with Tim Robinson from SNL and Sam Richardson from Veep. Sam and I used to do improv together in a group we called Members Only Improv. So to watch like all this stuff come out of Detroit, Eminem, all sorts of things, is really exciting. I mean, I love my city. I know it has its problems like every major city does, but I think that's kind of part of its mystique. I think that it's just such a universally crapped on and hated city, and I think it's given us so much, from Motown to what we have now, to the arts, to, I mean, just the cool buildings, the cool districts, the people. I mean, I love my city, and it's nice to hear somebody say something nice about it, because usually it's the complete opposite.
Well, and usually that's coming from people that haven't been there.
Well, yeah. And
or I mean, that didn't let it in when they were there.
And downtown is like downtown Chicago now. It's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, you're doing a thing at the Park Bar. It's a gorgeous area. There's nothing to be afraid of down there. But, I mean, there's suburban Detroiters who won't go down there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're just terrified of it. And it's sort of ridiculous, you know? Like, basically, the 60s happened. It got burned to the ground. There were riots. And it changed what was once called the Paris of the Midwest and this, you know, rising city into a wasteland for a long time.
But you know what I've noticed is that there's these people that love their neighborhoods, are committed to their neighborhoods, will never ever leave.
Absolutely.
You don't really see that anywhere anymore. That's nothing that you'll get. And I mean, you see it.
Yeah, but it's
not
a huge,
common anymore.
It's huge there. And even parts that are the, you know, really rough parts of the city, there will be a house that's just gorgeous because people don't want to live or leave the area that they love. But yeah, it's not common. People love Detroit. People love, I don't know, the city. They love where they're from. And I think I'm proud of it. I like it. I like how it keeps getting more and more press. I like how it keeps building. I like all the stuff that they're doing with it right now, what's happening to it right now. I don't know. I love my city.
Well, let's dive into some of the stuff that led you to writing the movie. You talked about that drugged out childhood.
Yes.
Let's start going down that path.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Walk me through it.
Well, it's a tough one. When I was 13, 14, I started experimenting, you know, cigarettes, drugs, all that kind of stuff. And when I was 14, my dad got diagnosed with brain cancer. And that's when, basically, my dad started his life with nothing. And he worked very, very hard to do really well. And he made a lot of money, and he did very well in insurance and some other things. But once he got sick, he moved to Harvard Hospital in Boston. So him and my mom and my brother sometimes lived there. And I was being watched by a woman who had sort of babysat us through our entire life just to keep an eye on me. And while she was babysitting me, she actually killed herself. And, oh, wow. So, like, there was just sort of this...
Was she struggling with... Was it...
She was a drug addict, and okay. She was a nurse, nobody knew, but she had been taking medicine from the hospital.
Oh, wow.
And she got caught, and basically before they arrested her and she lost her job, she ended her own life.
Oh, jeez.
So...
Sorry.
Oh, yeah. But at the time, I was dealing with a little bit of abandonment issues because my dad was living up in Boston. I wasn't really brought there. I was kind of kept in the dark, but I was aware that he was very sick.
What was it like going through all that with your dad?
It was very hard. I mean, dealing with the healthcare system, you have to... You know, he was in Harvard Hospital in Boston, so he could see a neurosurgery specialist, as well as U of M in Ann Arbor. So you have to look at those, that he's living in Detroit, he's living in Ann Arbor, he's living in Boston. He's footing all those bills himself because the insurance companies aren't covering them. My dad, who was at one time a multimillionaire and actually became that from scratch, not like Trump. He wasn't handed anything. He grew up in the ghetto. He never met his father. He worked his ass off for everything that he ever had. And as he got sick, he worked for an insurance company, and they had ruled that his brain tumor had been there since birth. So to keep himself alive, he was spending all of his money that he earned. Every single penny was going to keep him alive. Everywhere, and these aren't small bills. Think of what just an apartment in Boston cost.
Mm-hmm.
Just that, to stay there, so you can visit people. Yeah, so people can visit you and you can get your surgery and that kind of a thing. He's paying for the surgeries, and these aren't minor surgeries. These are $100,000 surgeries. These are all very expensive. So I watched him deteriorate. I watched him lose everything. I watched him going from being Superman into nothing, and I just hate the insurance companies for it because I watched them steal everything from my dad. And it's absolutely amazing just to hear people now talk about universal health care. And really the sad part about it is they ruled it as it being there from birth, but what we're finding out now is it wasn't there from birth. It was actually from Agent Orange because my dad was in Vietnam. Yeah. So it came off at such a young age because my dad was in Vietnam at a very, very young age. So the thing that actually had gassed and killed him was, in fact, our government. It just took a very long time, which actually eventually led to my mom's suicide. So really, that entire thing, Agent Orange, is responsible for me not having either of my parents right now. So it's just amazing now, too, with universal health care, where had we had that in line, my dad would have gotten the surgery that he needed, probably would have lived longer. And it's just astonishing for people who make money to go, do you have any idea what that would cost me to have universal health care? Well, what did your system cost me? It cost me my father. It cost me my mom. It cost everything that they ever earned. It cost the psyche of me and my brother. I don't have any of that anymore. All because that we had an insurance company that basically told us that he was born with a brain tumor and stole every single penny that he had when, in fact, it was Agent Orange. So I'm sorry to get off on a tirade, but to deal with that now and the fact that we're kind of in the middle of this thing trying to figure out what we're going to do about the fact that we found out it was Agent Orange, because we found out recently from a third party that his soft tissue sarcoma was actually the result of the gassing of the troops that happened. So right now we're just trying to get through it. But yeah, the last few years with my dad was, he played football for Perlis. He, like I said, he grew up without a father. He was a very tough man, but he was also like Rodney Dangerfield, just one-liner after one-liner. The funniest man I've ever known. He used to wake me up on the weekends so we could watch SNL together when I was a little kid. The reason why I do comedy is because of my father, and he died when I was a teenager, and that really, really messed me up. And to watch him lose everything really messed me up, too. So it was rough.
Wow.
And I... you know, I more and more just started becoming somebody who didn't go to class, hung out at night, would go to raves, you know, selling weed, doing drugs, and really alcohol was probably my main thing. But I mean, I spent 5 years in high school. I wasn't unpopular or anything. I just was a completely screwed up all the time.
Why 5 years? What happened there?
Oh, I would just take 6 hits of acid and go to class, or do Special K in the parking lot and go to class, or ecstasy, or, you know, whatever, just skip everything, and eventually...
So you, like, had to be held back, or...
Oh, yeah. I mean, okay. I would smoke pot in the class. Like,
oh, wow.
How
did that go?
It went really well. I could get away with it in the library pretty good, and in this computer lab that we had, and I would hit a pipe throughout the class until one day the teacher came up to talk to us, and I had to hold in a toke, and I was, like, coughing so bad that I zero-toked in front of her. Like, when I coughed, nothing came out. But fortunately, she didn't really notice for whatever reason, but I kind of stopped pushing it that far.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I did it. I'm dealing with it now. But my dad had just, you know, I just... a lot of stuff was really heavy on me then, and I just... Everything that comforted me was alcohol and drugs. I ended up getting arrested 12 times before I was 21, and it was all for alcohol-related arrests. So I was just a raging alcoholic. I loved it, and it comforted me, which I've now learned from a therapist was almost my way of surviving. It was my way of coping, and it was my way of dealing with the things that were bothering me, because I didn't have the adult skills that were necessary to deal with it. But I was basically just a little criminal. I was not a good kid, and I shouldn't say I wasn't a good kid, because I was, but I was just, I was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and I think the one day I realized it was really severe, I was eating lunch in a food court, and my hand wouldn't stop shaking, and I drove...
How old were you at that
point? 16.
Okay.
Yeah, and I drove down the street to Piccadilly, where I would get beer that's featured in the movie, and I bought half a pint of Bacardi Limon, and I slammed it on the way back to the food court, got in and finished my food because it steadied my hand.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, that was at a time where I would have such bad withdrawal. Like, I would see a room of people that weren't there. Like, there would be, like, a little girl on the side of my bed that, like, didn't exist. But it was all part of, like, DTs that I would have that were so bad that I was actually experiencing hallucinations. So I realized that I was a lot deeper into it than a lot of people. But, I mean, I just treated it by drinking more. So the movie itself, I mean, this is a side thing, you know, that you asked, but that's more of a comedy and more of, you know, something just based on teens of that era. My own life was fairly dark at that time.
Oh, and you had a couple fairly significant run-ins with law enforcement as well.
I did. I was harassed in my area. And this is, again, not on every cop, but... you know, which I just say out of fear. But, yes, I did. Two specific times was one time I was at a party, and the cops came, and I ran. I want to say I was 16 or 17.
Okay. That was a rough year for you.
Yeah.
Driver's license and now everything.
Yeah.
It's
tough to say because I'll tell you the first night I drove and borrowed my dad's car, I wrapped it around a tree. So that's a different story. So the ages 16 to 18 are a bit of a blur. So I could be wrong on the exact age I was. But I'm going to say 16 because I was pretty young. And I was at a party and I was the cops came and I was upstairs hiding underneath a bunch of clothes in this girl's closet. Now the cops came, which normally you just... tell the party to leave. You can give MIPs or, you know, minor in possessions. You can give tickets.
Mm-hmm.
But you can only start searching somebody's house or just come in without knocking. But this particular cop did. And he was always the one harassing me. And he just started looking through the entire house until he found me. And him and his partner came up, brought me to the edge of a staircase, and in front of everybody just dropped me down it. To a sea of kids just screaming, Rodney King, Rodney King, Rodney,
oh,
you know.
Wow.
And it's like if it was on YouTube today, it would be absolutely amazing.
Yeah,
but,
right. You'd be a draw everywhere
I
just because of that.
Right?
Man, that
I know, I'd be huge. If only YouTube was around to see police abuse me.
Well, wait, how did you have a history with that particular cop? Like you said, like
he had arrested me a lot of times.
Okay.
He gave me my second DUI. He gave me most of my MIPs. He just saw me at parties, and I was a little kid. I mean, now I'm 5'5", or 5'6", whatever the hell I am. You know, like, then I was probably 5'2", and 120 pounds wet. I was easily... It was easy to pick on me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fortunately, I had a bunch of big friends, so that wasn't really an issue in school, but with him, I was an easy target. And he just didn't like me. He had a hard-on for me. And one night, I was working on my car in my driveway, and by working on it, I had accidentally crashed into my garage, and I was trying to straighten out the bumper. And he comes back, and he's just like, he's like, "Dude, what are you doing? Like, what are you,
Oh, wow, here we go.
Yeah. He just walks to the back with two other cops, and he's just like, "What are you doing? Are you drinking? Have you been drinking?" I'm like, "No, not drinking." And I was drunk, but I'm like, "No, not always. Are you drinking and driving?"
So this was the same guy that threw you down the stairs.
Same guy. Oh, he's like, "You drinking and driving? What are you doing tonight?" I'm like, "No, I'm not doing anything." He's like, "What are you doing? Like, what? Why don't you do something with your life?" And he just started poking me.
Now, how old were you then?
I want to say 17.
So this was like just a year later then?
Probably months.
Oh, sheesh, man.
Yeah, and I want to say the thing that I just described happened in the fall, and this was the following spring.
Wow.
So he just started kind of poking me with his nightstick, and he just goes, "What are you going to do with your life? Why don't you do something with life?" And I was like, "Well, I could do something special." And I went, and I go, "I could become a pig like you," and I spit right between his eyes. But wow. When I did it, one of the cops came up behind me and just cracked me with a nightstick, and I just went down. Then when I got back up, just hit me. Oh, I just said his name. Well, that's his name. And he just hit me across...
I can edit it if you want.
I don't care. He knows what he did. He hit me across the chest with a nightstick. And then basically all three cops just beat the crap out of me in my driveway. Now, they didn't arrest me, and I never told my parents because I really just didn't want to get in trouble for drinking. I still had that little kid mentality. You might want to edit that. Yeah. I don't want to get sued.
His name?
Yeah,
I'll edit his name. Don't worry about it.
But basically, I still had that mentality where I was afraid of them. And I just, afraid of my parents. Like, I didn't want to get in trouble. I didn't want to get grounded. I didn't want to, because my dad was dying of cancer. I mean, he had a halo on. Things were not very peachy in my house. My mom was extremely bipolar. I just didn't want to tell them what had happened. So I just ignored it. And then I went on spring break, and I took my shirt off, and I was just covered in welts and bruises. And my friend, whose mom happened to be a judge, was just like, "What happened to you?" And I said, "Well, these cops beat the crap out of me in my driveway." And, you know, I don't know if it was her or whoever, but somehow the message got across to kind of stop, you know, the harassment of me.
So that guy stopped bothering you?
Pretty much. I mean, I think he gave me... Yeah, he might have given me my last DUI with them, which was where they found a 40-ounce of, like, malt liquor under my seat. I went to this place. I was 19 because I... 18. I still have the article at my house because I would cut out all the articles that would make the paper of my arrest. And I was 18 at the time. It was the last time he ever did anything to me. And maybe this one was fair, because I went to a mobile to buy nitrous. I just wanted to get a bunch of whipped cream cans, and I was pretty hammered. And I was clearly hammered, so the guy wouldn't let me in. So there was all of these soda bottles outside, so I just started filling my car with soda bottles while giving him the finger, and then I just drove away. Well, I got pulled over, obviously, for shoplifting from the side of a building, and it was the same cop. He walked up to the car, found a 40 underneath my seat. I blew under the legal limit, but it was still above because I was under 21. And that was the last time he ever arrested me.
What ended up happening to that guy? Is there any, like... Because, I mean, he was still... I mean, you were doing some bad stuff, but yeah, this was a corrupt cop still.
Yes, of course. Well, him or one of his partners later on ended up pulling a gun or shooting their fiancé. Then when the cops showed up to handle that situation, he pulled a gun on the cop. So that guy's actually in prison. So eventually, it all came full circle for him, which is a really nice thing to see.
Yeah.
When somebody gets
Well, how'd you feel when you heard about that?
Great. I could have beat off. I mean, I don't know. I think that he deserved it. I was a kid whose, you know, father was dying. I was a kid who really needed somebody there in my life. I had experienced a certain amount of pain, and a lot of people go, "Well, you still had him," and it's like, it's not the same to watch your father welt away for 4 years as it is to actually have a dad.
Sure.
You know, but I guess people don't know that until they see it. I mean, and at the time, before that last DUI, one of my very, very good friends was killed in a car accident while my other friend drove. And, you know, he ended up killing three passengers. And one was one of my very, very good friends. And that was just a whole nother thing that just led me to... It was a kid I drove to school every single day. You know, there's all these different things that sort of just lead you to do what you do, but I always would mask all of my pain with substances.
Mm-hmm.
And, it, you know, it... I guess it's survival. I guess it helps. There's a
this
lot of...
This woman had impeccable timing. Just impeccable. Well, I mean, so since we've been doing this, like one person has checked in, and she had very loud questions. I don't know about what. Where's my room? It's written down on the thing.
Right.
And then she just had, I don't know, I guess all of her belongings with her that she just wheeled in here.
Yeah.
It's like the one person.
I think it's important to just make, you know, cause chaos when it's just, here's your key. There's three numbers on it. Find that number.
Yeah.
Like, I just hate how no one is quiet in a hotel. Like, I'm always quiet. I'm always trying to, like, quietly shut a door.
Yeah.
Not talk in the hallway. But no, most people are just as loud as you can be.
Yeah. And I get it. She needed to wheel her stuff in, but really, did it have
probably
to be...
didn't.
Did it have to be this person?
It was probably just didn't want to lift it.
Yeah. No, you're probably right.
We could all use wheels, but let's be honest. You didn't need them.
Well, so then, how did you start coming out of all this? Because I mean, now you're a filmmaker, you're a comic, you've been on TV a bunch of times, like you're doing great.
Thanks.
And so what? Talk about the transition, man. How did you beat all this, or at least, you know, overcome?
Start to combat it, I guess.
Yeah.
When I was 17, I was put into a rehab.
Okay.
First, I was put in a mental hospital for about a week. And I actually talk about that on stage, where I wasn't necessarily supposed to be in the mental hospital. There just weren't rooms in a rehab. So I roomed with a guy who had who thought he was a wolf. And, you know, you had to talk every single week in these groups, and it was a weird place, because I was there because I was an alcoholic, and then other people were there for, you know, schizophrenia and those kind of things. Like, one girl, I'll never forget, she was 13, and her dad was molesting her, so she sharpened a spoon and took his eye out with it.
Wow.
Which I thought, like, hats off. Good for you.
Yeah, but, I know there's a lady that's on the same college roster as me that does a lecture because she, you know, her dad was horrible to her and just was completely abusive, raping her and everything. And the one day that he went after her sister was when she snapped and she killed him.
Jeez.
And it made national news and stuff, but then, you know, when she was in prison, she really did a lot of work and she did a lot of social work. Now she runs an organization for abused women, like
good
a nonprofit.
Yeah.
And she lectures about it, you know, to just raise, you know, like try to bring awareness to sexual assault, how to combat it, and how she just felt like she had no other choice because nobody was doing anything. And then she, it's pretty heavy stuff, man.
No, to feel alone and victimized like that, I can only imagine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been very lucky. That's never been an experience that I've had to deal with.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
I found out a guy who worked on my porch recently has been accused of that, and now with his daughter and son. And I wanted to rip out every brick on my porch.
Right.
And just if I see the guy, your initial instinct, like just being a father, and I think anybody can agree with it, but just my initial reaction to any kind of sexual child abuse is just put the guy down.
Yeah.
And maybe that's extreme, but I don't think you get to live anymore. And that's just my, like, I don't blame that girl for what she did. And I mean, maybe that's not the answer, but that's just how I feel about it. I don't think there's a place for those people.
Oh, yeah. No, it is one of those things. And that's why they even say, like, in the prison system, those people are just brutalized because,
right.
You know, a lot of people in there, they probably went through something similar. And that's somewhere it's like there is no sympathy for doing that to a kid, nor should there be.
Well, there shouldn't be. It's victimizing anything that's defenseless.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's disgusting to me.
So, getting back
anyway,
to you.
Yeah, good times.
There's a sidebar.
This is a comedy show?
What do these guys do? They do stand-up, right? Both of them? Okay.
Really? Is this it? I'm just sad now and think there's no hope.
So, but there is hope.
There is
hope.
So
you beat, you, you know, overcoming a lot of what you overcame.
I started realizing it when I was in rehab, my addictions. And when I started in comedy, I met my wife at Second City. She convinced me to do stand-up. I mean, it's a long story, but I just started doing stand-up, and I loved it, and it kind of became my own addiction. Now, I was still having battles with alcohol, but I never had them at shows, at clubs, anything like that. I was always very professional. I didn't get drunk on stage. I mean, I'm sure once or twice, but it was never anything that ever really affected me in an insanely negative way. Until probably, I got married in 07, and right around 08, I just really was kind of back into binge drinking. Mm-hmm. And I'm not like a fun drinker. Like, everybody says I'm Three Beer Dave because I go from being a very nice guy to just ripping everybody apart. And then I black out and I don't remember anything. And I wake up, like we've talked earlier today about Catholic guilt. The feeling that I get of blacking out is, it's just not worth being alive. I mean, I torture myself after doing these things to
guilty
myself.
Guilty for what you know you did that you don't remember?
Or didn't. I don't know what I did.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's huge chunks of my life where I don't know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's kind of a terrifying thing.
Certainly.
There's nights where I don't know. Like, you know, I'm the kind of guy where I'd have to be like, oh, wow, I'm in my own bed. You know, better go check the front bumper for some, you know, bloody shoes or...
Like, oh, wow.
A dent. You know, fortunately, I got lucky every time. But there's just things that I don't, you know, and who knows if I drove those nights. I don't know, because you start drinking one place, and I wake up, and I'm somewhere else. And they say blackouts can come back to you. They've never come back to me. I don't remember. And, you know, there's just huge, I'm just a blackout drinker.
So it's just people filling you in?
Yeah.
At best.
At best. And usually what they fill you in with is never anything good.
Yeah, it's usually painful to hear.
Absolutely. And my wife, she stood with me for a long time. I don't know why. But she stayed with me, and I continued to drink. And the night of my last DUI, which was in 09, which I really sobered up after that, I had gotten in a fight with her. I don't know what it was. And I had been drinking and playing poker all night. And... yeah, that was my last DUI. I left, and one of my tires was even flat, and I just was like, oh, who cares? I just drove and ended up getting arrested. And my mugshot, I weigh probably 50 pounds more than I do now. I had a beard. Like, I just look like I was just broken, and I just somehow went back into that. And I realized kind of then what was the most important to me in my life, and that was... you know, my wife, comedy, my friends, and just sort of, I just needed to keep, if I focus on positive things, sorry if I'm all over, but I'm still figuring this out.
No, you're answering the question, man. Yeah. Take as long as you need.
Yeah, it's I'm still figuring it out, you know, but
certainly.
It's like,
yeah, it's a journey. But...
right, and it comes out more and more in my stand-up and more in my stories, because I want people to know they're not alone, you know, it's okay to be sick, it's okay to be an alcoholic, it's okay to be an addict, it's okay if you've been victimized. It's okay. Like, there's everybody in the world has some experience of something that's painful.
Mm-hmm.
And I relapsed a couple times since then. One was when I was kicked off Last Comic. I was really broken by that.
What year was that?
It's 2 years ago.
Okay.
But I only did once. And I was I was at my niece's baptism. And there was a keg there, and I was just depressed, and I just kept drinking out of the keg and drinking out of the keg, and my wife's basic response was, well, I knew this might happen, I'm just glad I was there.
Yeah.
And it didn't get too bad. I kind of caught myself and stopped myself, and, you know, I'm not... it was like maybe, I guess, 3 years ago now, but I kind of stopped it before anything went awry. But I had a couple relapses, but in 6 years, for the way I used to drink, I don't... think that that's a bad thing.
Get into Last Comic as a quick aside, because sure. you upset Roseanne.
Right? I upset Roseanne, yeah. Like, it really, like, I guess what was so odd to me is if you watch my clip, basically the first one, they opened the season with me. It's 5 minutes of my comedy. It's essentially a late night appearance in primetime. I'm very lucky. They all say I'm probably going to win the show. And then the, basically fast forward to the episode where this happens, I'm on stage, and I have a killer set, and Roseanne didn't get the joke. just didn't get it. Okay. She starts screaming about how she doesn't get it. The audience is yelling at her. Keenan and Russell are trying to explain it to her, but I knew that she got it. She just didn't like it and was offended by it. You could feel it.
Okay.
So I just kept making jokes about it and making the joke more and more about her and at her and sort of teasing her with it, which I know she didn't like. But I was that step away from breaking. I was that one round from life-changing, you know? And after, at that time, 10 years I had been in this, it meant the world to me. And I even, like, the producers brought me out, they put me front and center, everything looked like I was going to go through. And they just sort of pulled the carpet out from under me. Not saying that I deserve that or anything, but, you know, I really felt that I earned it that season, and I was screwed over. Like, it's just weird to say. I offended Roseanne Barr, so I'm not on a show anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's just nonsense. Like, it doesn't even, it never registered, but it hurt. You know, so, yeah, that, it did hurt, you know. And fortunately, I gained some fans, and for 3 months I sold out clubs, and that went away. But that's kind of how that goes. You know, there's really no staying power in comedy anymore. But when it aired, it reminded me of what happened, and I was pretty fragile about it, and I ended up drinking. And people can say, like, oh, woe is me, like, whatever. You boo-hoo, you were on a TV show and you didn't get as far as you wanted. But it's like saying that the promotion that you always wanted was given to somebody else right in front of you. How would you feel at your job?
Mm-hmm.
If it was something that you earned? You
know? Was it just one relapse? Like one instance? Or
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, what I found out, you know, over time I've gotten better and better. And then in October of last year, or November of last year, which is just 3 months ago, my mom committed suicide.
Sorry.
Thank you. And, she was a bipolar. She's very up and down, mood swings, that kind of thing. But my mom was a really good person. And I had a lot of trouble talking about it for at least a couple months, or admitting to what actually happened, because the stigma of that is so severe that I don't think people see past it and see the person. You're just the suicide now. Does that make sense?
No, it does make sense. I had someone really close to me go through something similar, where it was actually her mom was diagnosed very severely. I actually forget what she had off the top of my head. I mean, it was one of those kind of rare things, but it was getting to the point where it was going to soon be fatal. So her mom and her stepdad actually jointly took their lives together.
Jeez.
Yeah. And it was, so yeah, and I can relate to the way, you know, you put that, having seen what she went through.
Right.
Because she was saying how they oversimplified it, you know, that they kind of just saw it as a, they just saw it as the thing that happened.
Right.
The technical murder-suicide, instead of these were people that felt desperate, that felt lost, and decided to do this together. And it's terrible.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Well, exactly. And nobody, our entire system of dealing with this now is just load somebody with drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I feel depressed. I feel bipolar. And I'm saying you shouldn't be medicated to some degree, but my mom did go and seek help and was basically just, oh, here's your prescription. Here's your prescription. Here's your prescription. And for a woman who was a nurse and an RN for most of her adult life, she was aware how all of this was pretty dangerous. And, you know, my wife and I had just had our first child in March, and my mom couldn't have been more lit up and elated. She couldn't have been more happy to be a grandma. I hadn't seen my mom that happy in forever, and she was a great grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just on a side thing, like you were saying with the stigma, like even when it happened at the funeral, we're trying to figure out what to tell people, and I'm basically telling people, like, oh, we have to do an autopsy to find out. Like, it was just weird, you know, like people knew. But anyway, my mom kept getting loaded and loaded with these various drugs, which I think were just continuing the damage. You know, I don't think they were helping. I think they were just putting her brain through more loop-de-loops and whatever else she was experiencing. But she was all excited to be a grandma, and everything was good. And then all of a sudden, she just locked herself in her room for 6 days. And I didn't know she was in there. And then I just got a phone call. Your mom passed away, and she had just taken a bottle of Vicodin and a bottle of sleeping pills.
Oh, jeez.
And her note just said, to Michael and David, I'm at peace, love, Mom. And Michael is my twin brother.
Wow.
So when that happened recently, you know, people gave me joints at the funeral home. People gave me, you know, anybody's like, you can drink, you can have a few beers, you know, it's fine, we all get it. And I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I kind of realized I've sort of may have actually really overcome this thing. And I started seeing a psychiatrist, and I deliberately found somebody who refuses to prescribe drugs.
Oh, wow.
Because I just want to be treated, and I want to talk about it, and I want to know what's wrong with me. I don't want somebody to give me a pill and be like, there's your sunshine. Like, I just want to know what in me is causing this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good to know, you know, it's good to talk about it, it's good to get it out there, because I obviously have some of the issues that my mom had. And the reason why I'm talking about it so openly now is if anybody feels depressed or bipolar or feels that something's down or they want to end their life, it's, you know, people love you. And it's a cliche and maybe silly thing to say, but somebody out there really, really loves you and cares about you. And that's not the answer. It really is a long-term answer to a short-term problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a selfish thing to kill yourself, in my opinion. It's just somebody who's so low that they don't see any other option.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that people get mad at people who do it, I don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I fully agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's, I've had that conversation with so many people.
Of course.
That it's like, no, that they just felt like they weren't. And yeah, like the kind of subtle guilty things that we have in our society around it, I've never agreed with. It's like, you know, you gotta try to show people how, you know, there's always an option, but without, you know, casting some kind of judgment or some kind of preconceived notion, like the whole, like, oh, it's selfish, or the whole, like, oh, you're just putting the pain on someone else. It's like, you can't, that's not gonna help.
Absolutely not. And yeah, your entire body from the moment you're in the womb, your body works with your mind. They're two separate instruments, which is one main goal of surviving
mm-hmm.
and staying alive. When one of those instruments is so broken that it's convincing you to go against every natural instinct you have, which is survival, there's clearly something wrong. So to say that somebody's selfish because they're essentially damaged, I think is just a stupid thing.
Yeah.
And I've had people in my family argue, like, how selfish is that to take it away from your son, to take her away from your son and that kind of thing. And it's like, it's not selfish, it's just she had no other option. And I've been there. There's plenty of nights where I came very, very close to killing myself.
Mm-hmm.
I fully understand what that feeling is. I didn't, because this is all there is, I think, in a way, you know. Mm-hmm. And my mom is, you know, she's one of those people too. She's a devout Catholic, and I don't understand, you know, people don't understand that. They're like, well, now wouldn't she just go to hell? Why would she do that? Well, because you're not taking in religion when you're that broken.
Right.
You're not weighing in all this bullshit. You're just,
you're
not weighing in all this bull crap. You're either happy or sad. You know what I mean? You're just so gone.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, to go back to the question, having that happen recently, and then a few days later, we had to put my dog down.
Oh, sheesh, man.
Yeah. Which,
Happy New Year, at least.
I know, right? It's 16. Whole new year. Who knows what'll happen.
Right.
We had to put my dog down. I have a son, but that dog was kind of my daughter. That was my kid.
Mm.
And it was just that, to go through both of those things right then and so traumatically, where I said, you know what, I'm going to get help. I'm going to talk to somebody. I'm going to start bringing this stuff on stage. I'm going to really start. I think even just a few months ago is when I realized that my hard work over the last few years is paying off, because I was able to handle something without the use of substances. And I'm really proud of myself for it.
That's awesome.
It's the first time I've been able to say that.
That's awesome.
You know, like, to take something traumatic and just handle it like a grown-up is a really nice feeling.
So where can people get your movie?
Oh, my comedy is available at movietheking.com. It's or Amazon, and the movie's called The King. Yeah, movietheking.com or Amazon.
And where can people find out where you're coming to a city near them?
DaveLandau.com.
DaveLandau.com.
LANDAU is an umbrella.
Thanks for doing this, man.
Thank you. Is that too much? Is that too dark?
No, that's perfect. Okay.
Dave Landau. So Dave texted me a little bit after we did our interview, and he told me that he did some research. It turns out it was the cop that was messing with him, his partner, that had the altercation with the fiance that then turned the gun on the cops. But all the charges were dropped. Dave followed up on the story. He assumed the guy went to jail. Turns out the guy did not go to jail. So that's something else, man. He mentioned it to me, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to mention it in a post-amble. It's something. I'm Ron Placone. You're listening to the Indie Bohemians.